From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Alan Finkel, whose term as Australia's chief scientist ends this month, has been in the post since 2016. His position has put him at the centre of some of the biggest issues of the day, including the climate and energy debates that have racked politics, and recently Australia's response to the pandemic, which has seen experts accorded a big role and, by and large, much respect. Dr. Finkel's own background is diverse. His PhD from Monash University is in electrical engineering. Over his career, he has worked as an entrepreneur, engineer, neuroscientist, and educator. Alan Finkel joins us today to talk about the role of the chief scientist and his experiences in it. Alan Finkel, could you start by telling us exactly what the remit of the chief scientist is? In particular, how independent can the person occupying that position in fact be?
Michelle, hi. Look, the specific remit, if you look at the contract, is to advise the Prime Minister, the Science Minister, and other ministers on matters to do with science, research, and innovation, in addition to engage with the public and inspire them on those same topics, and to assist the government where it reaches out internationally in science, research, and innovation. Of course, how one does that is very much dependent on the individual chief scientist. I have found that the role for me has been a mixture of two categories of activities. One is I've been asked to do a lot of reviews. I counted them up recently, which one does at the end of a term, and found that I've done just on a dozen reviews for the government. Some actually get called a Finkel review. Most of them go by their real name. Most of those dozen I've done as the chair of the panel supported by a task force. In some cases, I've been either a co-chair or a deputy chair. Those reviews, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of them specifically, are an incredibly important opportunity to synthesize information from the original literature through consultation with stakeholders across the NGO community, consumer communities, research stakeholders, industry stakeholders, public servants, and political ministerial stakeholders. They're an incredible opportunity to synthesize information and put it into a package that governments can really consider and ideally support. And as I said, we can talk more about those. The other category of things that I've done, what I lightheartedly call making things up, but much more substantially I would call developing programs to support the communication of science, technology, innovation, and research across the community. And so through my office, or with the support of my office, I have initiated a number of programs in school education and science policy that I'm very proud of, and continuing programs that I'm confident that my successor will continue. Part of your question was about independence. The role is actually quite independent. I'm asked to do a review. It's not likely that I'll refuse, and I do them, but I'm not told what to put in the review. The reviews, even if I deeply and frequently consult with ministers, the reviews are an independent synthesis of the information that is brought my way, and that synthesis is done between myself, the panel members, and the task force members. In addition, the ministers, the prime ministers, trust me to speak sensibly in a public forum and never direct me as to what to say. I always let them know through my office. I let them know that I'm about to be interviewed or about to give a speech, and as a courtesy, share a speech in advance if it's a written speech. But the role is actually quite independent.
two mega issues or sets of issues that you've been involved in are energy and climate policy on one hand and COVID on another. Now, going to energy, how frustrated were you by the setbacks, for example, the abrupt rejection of your clean energy target and the politics that still keep getting in the way of policy development in this area?
Well, Michelle, I was certainly somewhat personally disappointed and disappointed for the country that the clean energy target wasn't adopted. Of interest is that the inclination of the leadership was to adopt that.
This is the Turnbull government we're talking about, right?
That was the Turnbull government, and Josh Frydenberg was the energy minister. It was effectively something that wasn't acceptable to the backbench, and the Turnbull government came up with a strategic alternative, the NEG, the National Energy Guarantee, which effectively tried to achieve emissions reduction and reliability in the system a different way. And as you're very, very well aware, that wasn't successful either. It's a difficult area. On the other hand, I took a lot of comfort from the fact that the other 49 out of 50 recommendations were accepted and adopted, and most of them have been implemented, and some are still in the process of being implemented. And from the perspective of the climate, or sorry, let me say the emissions reduction aspect of those recommendations, a lot of them have been part of the reason that we've been able to introduce solar and wind electricity at extraordinary rates in the last 3 years. So some of the recommendations in the electricity review ensured that as large-scale solar and wind generators are connected, that they do not destabilize the electricity grid. Because what most people aren't aware of is that whilst solar electricity and wind-fired electricity are superb in the sense of being zero emissions, they're very badly behaved as generators intended to operate collaboratively on a large-scale grid. And solutions have to be built around them to ensure that the system stays stable. And the national electricity market had not anticipated that in its original design and had moved so slowly in its evolution that it wasn't coping with that. Now recommendations ensured that solar and wind come in stably. One of our recommendations was for approving long interconnectors for national benefit rather than just point-to-point benefit. Another one was to open up renewable energy zones, and you're seeing that now in New South Wales and Queensland and Victoria. Renewable energy zones, which are zones where currently there's not a lot of solar and wind generation, but the resources are there, but there was a lack of transmission lines. And the old market design didn't, it was a chicken and egg problem. You couldn't put in the transmission line without the generators. No one would put the generators in without the transmission lines, and we solved those problems. So in retrospect, I'm pretty comfortable that we triggered a transition in the right direction.
So if we're looking at the shape of Australia's policy on climate and energy at the moment, many critics say we're absolute laggards on climate policy. The government says we've met all the targets so far and we're in a good position to do so in the future. How do you rate our situation, and what do you see as the future for fossil fuels and renewables in Australia, say, by 2030?
I think the situation in Australia has improved substantially for the better in the last few years. We did have a leg up through the RET, the Renewable Energy Target, which was the stimulus that got solar and wind going in the country. But in the last 3 years, the investor sentiment, supported by what they've seen from state and territory governments and the signalling coming out of the Commonwealth government, has been such that we are installing solar and wind electricity in Australia at the highest per capita rate in the world in 2018, 2019, and I think it's likely to be the case in 2020. We have the highest rate of rooftop solar uptake. So that's moving in the right direction. On top of that, you've got the changes that came out of the electricity review I mentioned. You've got the adoption of the National Hydrogen Strategy last year, and we can talk about that more. But fundamentally, hydrogen will be a significant, not a dominant, but a significant component of energy delivery in the long term. And it's a zero emissions energy fuel. And the Australian National Hydrogen Strategy was adopted unanimously by all the states and territories and the Commonwealth government. Both branches of government, the Commonwealth and the states and territories, are investing money. Industry is investing money. Our National Hydrogen Strategy is really well perceived internationally. And so I'm extremely encouraged by that. This year, the government in September announced the Low Emissions Technology Statement, which is the first stake in the ground alongside the highway, the roadmap into the future. And the Low Emissions Technology Statement is describing how we can take measures to invest in new technologies across the economy, agriculture, industry, transport, the built environment, as well as electricity. And when that was announced, it was accompanied by $2 billion worth of funding by the Commonwealth government, or nearly $2 billion, and a statement or a commitment to a further $18 billion over coming years, with an expectation that industry will put in three, four, or five times as much as that again. So we're talking about $100 billion being invested into zero and low emissions technologies this decade. So I actually question or dispute the popular perception that we are laggards today. I'm not talking about where we were 3 years ago, but things have definitely improved for the better through the activities of the investment communities, the state, the territory, and the Commonwealth governments. The final part of your question was, what impact will that have on fossil fuels? Well, of course, if the demand is roughly constant or growing slowly, and a lot of the future demand is going to be provided by zero emissions solar and wind, then that will mean that we will need ever less coal-fired electricity and gas-fired electricity going into the future. What the rate of transition is just too difficult to predict, but it's very clear that as solar and wind take an ever-increasing percentage share of the annual generation mix in the national electricity market, that must be at the expense of coal-fired and or gas-fired, not and or, but coal-fired and gas-fired electricity.
There's a feasibility study underway at the moment for a new coal-fired power station in Queensland. The Nationals are particularly agitating for this, especially Matt Canavan, the former resources minister. Do you think such a project would ever get going?
The challenge for a new coal-fired power plant is not only the expectations of the community, but just the sheer cost of it all. If a new coal-fired plant was to be built or committed to today and built with carbon capture and storage so that it was a near zero emissions facility, the cost of the electricity from that plant could be five or six times higher per unit of electricity than the cost of electricity coming from solar and wind. That was a figure that came out of a publication from the Victorian Energy Institute yesterday, and the director, Bruce Mountain. Whether it's five or six fold higher or four times higher, everybody who's done an analysis of the cost of new coal-fired electricity shows that it's going to be higher than solar and wind electricity, even when that solar and wind electricity is firmed to some extent by batteries. So there's an economic challenge.
So you would say that we will not see in Australia a new coal-fired power station?
I would never predict anything, Michelle, especially about the future, but I can say with some degree of confidence that the economics would be challenging.
Now, of course, the Prime Minister has been very fulsome in his promotion of gas. Do you think he has overhyped the potential of gas?
You have to look at gas from two different perspectives. One is for industrial purposes, such as very high temperature heating or as a chemical feedstock. And the other is its role in the electricity system. And I must say that I personally have not looked at the industrial direct uses of gas. Within the electricity system, as we're transitioning out of coal-fired electricity and replacing that in the main with solar and wind, there has to be technology available for firming up the solar and wind because they are variable supplies. Now, increasingly, batteries are getting cheaper and available at scale that can fill a substantial fraction of that role. There is potential for pumped hydro as well. But gas today can fill the role of providing firming for solar and wind very easily. You can call it a backstop, if you like, for when the sun's not shining, the wind's not blowing. How much we need really depends on how quickly there is a shift from coal fire to solar and wind. If that shift is slow, then I think that we're likely to be able to use batteries in the main to provide the firming. But if that shift is fast, then we're going to need gas. But we're not talking about huge amounts. We're talking today in the national electricity market, the NEM, gas only constitutes about 8% of the annual generated electricity. And when we use gas, not as baseload, but gas for firming the output from solar and wind, those gas generators don't run many hours a year. So they're not running many hours. They generate probably about half of the emissions of a coal-fired generator when they are running. So they're generating lower emissions per unit of electricity. They're not running a lot of hours. So the net emissions from gas-fired generation to firm up solar and wind is not very high. So I think there is a role for gas in the electricity system for quite some time to come. In the very, very long term, in the next, say in the 2030s, we'll see massive use of batteries for that purpose, and we're going to see that. We are seeing that already. There have been a lot of announcements in the last few months in Victoria and Queensland and South Australia and New South Wales for mega scale batteries over the next few years. So it's difficult to know exactly how things will pan out, but to the extent that gas helps us to bring in solar and wind more quickly, and the consequence of emissions associated with that is very, very small, then I think we should use the tools available to us.
Just before we leave the areas of climate and energy, should Australia sign up quickly, immediately, to the target of net zero emissions by 2050?
That's absolutely a question for our politicians, not for me. But I would say to you that the things that I've just been describing that we're doing in Australia already in the last couple of years are actually the kinds of things that we need to do as we drive towards a low and ultimately zero emissions future.
So are you saying on present policies and projected policies, we can reach this target?
I don't think anybody can say anywhere exactly when any given economy can reach a net zero target, but I am saying that we're taking the right measures already consistent with a drive towards zero or low emissions.
You're just a very few weeks away from leaving your job, Alan Finkel. Do you have a personal view on signing up to this 2050 target?
I don't, and I'll tell you why. I'm not squirming out of it. I'd say that there are two ways to achieve excellence. One is to have a target and then think about how you might achieve it, and the other is to invest in policies and pathways that will lead you in the right direction. And I've got to say that for 23 years when I ran a company in Silicon Valley, we had a lot of low-level goals for each product, but we never had a high-level stretch goal to say in our niche area of neuroscience scientific equipment, we never had a goal to be number one. But we became number one because we invested in the right approaches to improving our products and gaining market share. So I don't think that there's only one way to proceed here.
Now, turning to the pandemic and Australia's response in particular, do you think COVID has ushered in a new era for experts, or will the greater respect that we've been seeing turn out to be a passing thing?
Michelle, a good question, and I'm fairly confident that the respect for expertise is deep this year and to a large extent will continue. We have seen Australia do so much better than comparable countries in how we've dealt with the pandemic. And it's because governments have listened to experts, not just in public health, but Treasury and economics experts, experts in public health, and also experts from the broader research capability of the country in science, in engineering, in social sciences and humanities, and then public health. I've had the opportunity this year to convene a new forum to deliver expert advice to government called the Rapid Research Information Forum, the RIF. And what the RIF does, it takes a single question from a minister and then within 2 weeks asks the most expert academics in Australia to put together a short answer for a policy-aware audience to give them a specific answer to questions like, will winter make the pandemic worse? Will studying from home have a permanent impact on the learning outcomes of young people in Australia? We take questions like that, provide them within 2 weeks to the government minister as a public response, and they have been well received by the government. And I would hope that that kind of mechanism will continue into the future.
And are these published separately by the group?
Yes. So you can find them on the website of the Office of the Chief Scientist. You can find them on the website of the Australian Academy of Science. And I think you'll find them on the websites of pretty much all of the Australian academies.
And do the ministers provide the questions, or are the questions sourced more widely?
The questions come from ministers, sometimes through a discussion process, sometimes spontaneously from the ministers.
When you're speaking about the respect for experts of many sorts, do you think it's true that the experts on climate have found their path rather more difficult than other experts? And why do you think this is so? Why have they been the centre of storms, no pun intended?
Look, I think they have found it difficult, but there seems to have been a change in recent times. Right at the beginning of this year, the Prime Minister, in his National Press Club speech in January, referring to the bushfires, made it very clear that the government recognises that climate change is driving more severe bushfires in Australia. And that is why he invited the CSIRO to do a report on climate and disaster resilience. And the terms of reference of that report start off by acknowledging that Australia's climate is changing. So there's a change, not just in the climate, but in the awareness of and acceptance of the reality and the impact. And I would say that the fact that this year the government's come out with the low emissions technology statement, which is specifically there and funded to reduce emissions, shows a responsible response to the concern. Look, at any given time, governments can't just say, well, the science says this, we must act this way. The challenge for a politician is to integrate inputs from a number of evidence bases and non-evidence bases, so from science and economics and public health for sure, but they also have to be very aware to their community expectation, aware of their community expectations and their colleagues. It's difficult. What I find as Australia's chief scientist, probably more correctly referred to conceptually as the chief scientific advisor, is that I directly, through the reviews that I do, through the Rapid Research Information Forum, through another practice we have called the Horizon Scanning Reports, can provide input to governments on specific topics and then help them to connect the dots so that the scientific message is clear. But at the end of the day, they have to make their decisions based on multiple inputs.
So what you're saying is suggesting that you think that pragmatism has to be mixed even in the scientific advice?
Well, I do. So I'm both an engineer and a scientist in terms of my careers. And what I call the engineering way, I'm not talking about politics here, but the engineering way is the art of optimization. You can't afford to pursue perfection. You know, take the bridge building example. If you seek perfection, you'll design a bridge that no one can afford to build. If you compromise, you'll design a build that no one wants to take the chance of driving over. You have to optimize a whole lot of parameters. That's life. Politicians have to do it for their challenges too.
So where do you think Australia stands with regard to evidence-based policy as we go into the new decade? Are we still relying too much on being a lucky country rather than a smart country?
I don't think so. Look, you know, we get criticised a lot for not being innovative, but to some extent, that's the way that people are measuring innovation, and most of the metrics, if not all the metrics that are currently out there to measure innovation, look at a linear process of funding research in universities and measuring how many papers get published and how much research gets translated into patents and how much gets commercialized, and that is an innovation pathway. But there's innovation in many, many other areas of the economy that are too difficult to measure. And because we're substantially a service economy, the innovation in the service economy, in banking, in the food industry, isn't measured, and we don't pat ourselves on the back and take credit for it, but we do that pretty well. But the area that is just stands out is what Australia has achieved with its, if you like, lucky natural resources, minerals, but how well we've done it. We're not the only country with huge iron ore reserves. There are many around the world, including Brazil and South Africa. But because we have been extraordinarily innovative, and despite our high salaries, we have more than 50% of the world iron ore export business. And another one, and it's sort of a pleasant surprise, but a critical mineral going forward as we decarbonize the economy is lithium. So lithium ore, the metal lithium, is critically important. And Australia has gone from being a minor player 10 years ago to now having more than 50% of the worldwide lithium export market. That's not luck. That's investment by mining companies, by financing companies, in developing those resources imaginatively, using automation and artificial intelligence and technology to get the best prices, the smallest environmental impact, the best safety profile, and capture more than half the worldwide market. I mean, that is a non-trivial achievement, and I'd have to say it's smart, not just lucky.
We do know that morale is reportedly quite low among Australia's scientific research community at the moment. Research funding is notoriously tight, and the pandemic has affected the situation. For example, ANU is squeezing its scientific staff numbers. Do you think the government should be doing more to safeguard the future of science and universities, or Are there other ways that this sector can stay strong into the future?
The sector is definitely facing difficulties. The pandemic, of course, has created problems across the community. Funding and research is always tight, and now it's tighter, and it's you know, because multiple factors have impacted that, not the least of which is the international student market. There's a lot of recognition of that. Just in the most recent budget, the government gave $1 billion just for next year to the university research community. As much as that is, it's a goodly number. It's still not as much as they've lost as a result of the pandemic. So there is a concern, and we are losing researchers from the system. I'm fairly confident that the funding will bounce back, but we will have potentially lost workers, really good, competent researchers from the system permanently. Universities are trying to manage their resources and keep those people employed to the extent that they can, but universities also have to be even more imaginative. And I'm not criticising universities. I think they've done an extraordinary job over the years, but they will have to engage even more effectively with industry and philanthropy, and they don't need me to give them that advice. They know that, and they're doing it. I'm reasonably confident that in a few years from now, the university sector will be, and the non-university medical research institutes and others will be doing quite well. But the pain at the moment is here and now and very tangible.
In general, do you think governments and the public, and especially young people, rate science highly enough in Australia?
It's never enough, but I think science is well perceived. I've certainly had the opportunity to give talks to a number of youth forums, Year 13, the National Youth Science Forum, and some education programs that we run through the Academy of Technology and Engineering, one in particular called Stella. And through my own office, we've developed a website called the Star Portal that puts young people in touch with providers of extracurricular activities, and it's well used. I think there's a thirst for it, but we're not doing as well as we should. It's part of a problem of being a successful, economically successful country, as we have been, that people sometimes lose sight of the fundamentals. But I was very encouraged today to see in the press the results of an international study called TIMSS that comes out, I think, every 3 years or thereabouts. I'm not exactly sure. But it's been going for decades. And our results this year have shown a significant improvement in the Year 8 maths and science capability, and I think the Year 4 science capability. So we've gone from being on a downward trend into a pretty decent uptick in the most recent test. I think that's because state government education systems for quite some time now have recognised the importance of science and mathematics and have been investing in trying to improve school engagement in those areas. So, Michelle, it's never enough, but at least we're moving in a better direction.
And you mentioned we should be doing more. What more?
Oh, look, it's more than just money. It's the intangibles. We have to be raising the aspirations of young students so that they want to improve their abilities in challenging and fundamental subjects. So one of the non-financial problems, if you like, is that there's been an excessive focus on ATAR scores, the ranking that you get, to almost to the exclusion of thinking about what subjects are the right subjects for young people to do. There's been a lot of discussion of that in the last few years, and I've been a participant in that. And there's a group of universities that are going out with what they call the Australian Informed Choices to help students understand that choosing fundamental subjects not just electives, is critical to their long-term success. And so that kind of messaging will help. But challenging students, helping them to raise their aspirations, if you like, their bar that they're trying to hurdle, and then coaching them to get over that bar successfully every time, that's what we've got to be doing. And that's, to a large extent, the responsibility of all of us, parents for sure, peers, but the state education departments, and they are working on it. It's also the curriculum material that we give to students and the extracurricular activities we do. It became clear to me when I did a project for the COAG Education Council, a project called the STEM Partnership Forum, through the consultations, that this idea of sending people into schools to talk about their careers, it doesn't work. The kids just see that as yet another talking head coming into the classroom. What young kids care about, young students, is problems, real-world problems that they might eventually be able to help solve. And so presenting all of our science and mathematics curricula in a context of real-world applications and real-world problems will help. And there are private industry vendors, there are government curriculum providers who now get that and are presenting information that is more appealing, curriculum information that's more appealing to young people.
And it's been interesting how young people have become very caught up in the whole movement on climate, hasn't it?
Well, they have, and that's exemplifies what I was saying. They see this as not just a real-world problem, but a huge real-world problem, and one that they are going to grow up into and inherit. And so they're vocal on that. But that's an opportunity for the teachers to present physics and maths and biology and all the science subjects in a particular context of here's the problem and here's how this discipline could contribute to helping to alleviate the problem.
Now, just finally, what does the future now hold for Alan Finkel?
Aha. Well, I've got 22 more days on the day that we're recording this podcast until the end of this year. And
that'll be clearing the desk.
So on January the 1st of 2021, I become a private citizen again. I've got three things in mind, Michelle. One is to actually learn to relax and not work on a Sunday and perhaps get up a little bit later in the day and re-engage with my circle of friends and family in a more relaxed fashion. Second, I'm going to get involved in private industry development of secondary school science and maths curriculum content, because I really enjoy it and find it very, very satisfying. And thirdly, I've been asked by the government to stay involved in one particular project, which is the Low Emissions Technology Roadmap. And I'm chairing, and I will be chairing, the Low Emissions Technology Investment Advisory Council that advises the Minister for Energy and Low Emissions, Angus Taylor, and the government on how we can, without sacrificing economic prosperity, drive our emissions profile ever increasingly downwards, downwards, and downwards.
Well, you'll have your eye on that 2050 date. Alan Finkel, all the best for the future. Thank you very much for talking to us today. And that's the end of our podcast for now. We'll be back with you soon. Many thanks to my producer, Tom Glassie. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.